from the National Catholic Register. This is Register Radio, bringing light and clarity to the news and topics that affect your life.
Again this week, all eyes are on Rome for the Synod of the Family. And today here on Register Radio, Jeanette DeMello gets an update from Rome on this second week of the Synod from Edward Penton. We'll also check in with Joan Frawley Desmond to talk about two recent anti-life laws now in effect in California and exactly what pro-lifers are hoping to do about that. Welcome again to Register Radio. It's a co-production of EWTN and the National Catholic Register. I'm Tom Price, along with Jeanette DeMello, editor-in-chief of the Register. Thanks for joining us. Our first guest, Edward Penton, is the Register's Vatican correspondent. He began reporting on the Pope and the Vatican with Vatican Radio before joining our Register team more than 10 years ago. Now, for the last year, he has led the Register's coverage of the Bishop's Synod on Marriage and the Family. Today, he's with us to discuss the second week of the Synod on the Family, now meeting in Rome.
Edward, it's really a pleasure to have you here with us again on Register Radio for week two, reporting on the Synod. What are the concerns of this week, number two, in the Synod?
Okay, and well, first of all, the general congregations are now moving on to the third part, or rather they've been discussing and they've completed discussions of the third part of the Instrumentum Laboris, the working document. And this part focuses on the more controversial issues, the more delicate issues of, for example, Holy Communion for the divorced and civilly remarried Catholics. These issues were always going to be contentious and controversial, and they've been widely spoken about in these last few sessions, especially the divorce and remarriage issue, mm-hmm. which is interesting in itself because a lot of people speculated that the Pope's annulment reforms, streamlining the annulment procedures that he released in September would kind of take the wind out of the sails, as it were, of the divorce and remarriage issues, but it hasn't actually, and it's still very much front and center of the debates at the moment, or at least it has been this week.
So, a clarification: church doctrine will not change, and what might change is the discipline. It is very important to keep that in mind.
Yes, the issue of divorce and remarriage, of course, many believe is a doctrinal issue, and head of the Polish bishops, for example, said today, I asked him, you know, about this issue, about the Eucharist and so forth, and he said, you know, it's a doctrinal issue, so we don't even touch it. We're excluding the whole divorce and remarriage issue, because for them, access to Holy Communion for divorced and remarried couples is a doctrinal issue. It's not a pastoral one. And yet there's this push among some synod fathers to move it to the bishops' conferences and to let the bishops deal with it, especially the German Episcopal Conference wants that. But that's a source of contention because, of course, the Polish bishops and others don't believe that's right because it's doctrinal, and so it should always be part of the universal church and come from the Vatican and from the Pope himself. So that's a crucial distinction to make and one area of concern among many synod fathers there.
Moving that decision to the local bishops' conference, and that being a concern, what are you hearing from the Synod Fathers themselves?
Well, that's just being debated. I mean, there's been nothing decided. And, of course, it's important to remember that this is an advisory body for the Pope. It has no doctrinal or legislative power. Its canonical structure is simply to advise the Pope and really to strengthen and preserve doctrine and discipline. So if there is this push to devolve powers of the doctrinal nature to episcopal conferences, then that not only would that be problematic for the church as a whole, for many bishops, but also it goes against the nature of the synod itself. So there's a lot of concern that might be going ahead. But as I say, it's all up to the Pope at the end of the day. It's up to what he wants to do. And there's a push, really, to get him to really write a final document. It's still not decided yet whether he's going to publish the final report or if he's going to publish what's called a post-synodal apostolic exhortation, which is kind of his summary and his take on the whole synod. And it will be this synod and last year's. And it's still not clear if that's going to happen. And if it doesn't, then people are concerned, you know, that these issues will still be up for debate even long after the synod. So they want some definitive answer to these very important questions.
What concerns do you have from the perspective of how the Synod has been covered in other, especially secular media outlets?
That's been also another point of concern, in the sense that what the media, what the Holy See Press Office has been talking about, have been rather controversial propositions being put forward by Synod Fathers. Not to say that the Church is, you know, teaching or in any way what they're going to adopt, but just by putting it out there that certain bishops are talking about really quite, you know, I mean, way beyond what would be established, sort of considered established Church teaching in some ways. That's being put out there, is being discussed, and of course the media pick up on that, and they will say, well, the Church is now considering giving Holy Communion to divorced and remarried couples, you know, and that's causing a bit of concern there, because these are just points of discussion, they're not points of any decision or legislative, they don't have any legislative nature yet.
This is Elena Rodriguez, and we are here on Register Radio speaking with Edward Penton, the Register's Rome correspondent. Edward, once that post-synodal document comes out, the conclusions come out, how do we understand that post-synodal document?
Well, it will be a magisterial document. So in other words, it becomes part of the Pope's magisterium, part of his teaching. It's not an ex cathedra statement. It's not infallible, but it's... But when it comes to faith and morals, of course, it is. And that's why it's very important that he does make it clear where he stands on these issues and what the Church should do going forward in terms of pastoral practice in relation to all these issues, these important issues. So that's another reason why it is important that he makes it clear, because it will carry some weight. I mean, an apostolic exhortation, it's not as high as an encyclical, but it's not far behind. And so it does have quite a bit of magisterial weight. And the final report, too, I mean, that's going to be drawn up by a commission of 10 Synod Fathers, but it will still have a certain magisterial weight, too.
I see. Edward, are there any parts of the Relatio or the Instrumentum Laboris, that the document coming into the Synod, that have been perhaps completely tossed out from the discussion to give way or priority to other sections of it?
Yes, well, we haven't seen yet. We won't know what the... final amendments are until the end, but there have been a lot of changes. I mean, people have said, you know, the Instrumentum Laboris is a working document, it's not a final document, so it's there to be changed. But there have been a lot of problems with it, and certain small groups have been very vocal about, you know, quite scathing about it and how much they want it changed. I think there's something like, on the first part, there have been something like 350 amendments already, and on the second part 400 amendments. So there are a lot of changes to it. It should look quite different to how it was going in to how it will be coming out.
This is Elena Rodriguez, and we are here on Register Radio speaking with Edward Penton, the Register's Rome correspondent, giving us a full report of week two of the Synod in the Vatican, the Synod on the Family. Edward, for the final procedure of writing that final document of the Synod, once it's written, who supervises and makes sure that what was actually agreed on the Synod is what comes out in writing on the document?
Well, that's a good question, because, I mean, there is this commission that's going to draw up the report is also an oversight commission. It's looking, it's sort of monitoring the three-week Synod as well. So they're, in a sense, their own overseers, if you like. So they'll be writing it, but also monitoring themselves. But they will draw up this final report, drawing, of course, from the amendments made to the Instrumentum Laboris, which is the main text for the past 3 weeks. So that is a very important input for them in writing the final report. And then it goes to the vote. It goes to a vote to the Synod Fathers, and then it goes back for further amendments, and then it's given to the Holy Fathers. It is a fairly good check on the process with regards, you know, the Synod Fathers do have a say, but it's still a bit unclear quite how the process is going to work out in practice, and whether, again, if the Holy Father is actually going to publish it. I mean, we may not even see it. So that's all to be decided in the coming days.
Edward, our time is almost up, but I want to point our listeners to your excellent coverage of Rome issues, and especially this week and these weeks with the Synod on the Family from the Vatican. And the website is ncregister.com, where our listeners can read more of the journalistic work that you are doing in your research and investigation. One last question before we let you go, because you have reported on this, about the moral teaching of the Church being the same everywhere. And we look at different continents and different cultures and different mindsets, but even though maybe the pastoral way to apply a certain part of Church doctrine might be a little bit different depending on the culture, but the moral teaching of the Church is the same everywhere. You are hearing that from the Synod Fathers as well.
That's right, yes. That came particularly from Carla Rosa Serino of Venezuela, who made it clear, you know, despite ways to change the way these teachings are said in different languages, for example, but the moral teaching never changes. And he's very keen to say that polygamy is a big issue in Africa, for instance. Mm-hmm. So there has to be some way of dealing with that pastorally. But obviously, there's different issues in the West which need dealing there. But the natural law, of course, doesn't change, and the moral teaching doesn't change. It's just a different way of better approaching these issues with those people who are most affected by them. So that's an important issue to point out as well. But also, although for all the sort of upheavals the Synod has caused, Cardinal Rosa and others have said, you know, it's been a wonderful experience. He's found it very helpful. Mm-hmm. And, you know, even though it's been a sort of sausage-making practice that, you know, not particularly pleasant to look at, he's very optimistic that in the end, you know, good will come from it. So I think that's important to bear in mind, that that it should all come out in the right way, and we just have to trust in God that it will.
Amen. And we do keep the Synod Fathers and the Holy Father in our prayers. We keep you, Edward Penton, and all of the staff and writers at the National Catholic Register in our prayers as well. We want to thank you again for your excellent journalistic coverage, your extra effort all these weeks during the Synod, and thank you very much for being here on Register Radio.
Thanks, Eleanor. God bless.
When we return, there are two new laws in effect in California that are clearly anti-life. We're going to talk about what pro-life advocates want to do about that coming up next. This is Register Radio on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. More in a moment.
In today's world, we have all kinds of misinformation and even disinformation about Christianity, Catholicism, and religion in general. And we need a source that is going to give us direct quotations and authentic news about what is going on in the Church, so we know what the Pope really said and not what the media said he said. We need to know what the Synod is doing, what the encyclicals mean, in order to be able to give the facts of our faith. For that reason, we need the National Catholic Register, which will give us the good news along with the hard news of our world today. And in that way, we can have what we need to go out to our world and give them the good news of Jesus Christ.
For a free 6-issue trial of the National Catholic Register, go to EWTN.com and click on the banner for the Register, or call 800-421-3230 for your 6 free issues.
Let's return to Register Radio on EWTN.
And welcome back. Along with Jeanette DeMello, I'm Tom Price. Our next guest, Joan Frawley Desmond, is the Register's senior editor. Joan is an award-winning journalist, widely published in Catholic, ecumenical, and secular media. Joan is here this time to talk with Jeanette about those new laws we were just talking about just passed in California.
Joan, it's great to have you on Register Radio again. And this week, we're talking about your home state of California and a couple of dark things that have happened there in just the past couple of weeks. This week, Governor Jerry Brown signed a bill that really jeopardizes crisis pregnancy centers. And this bill concerns many of the centers. They're not sure if they'll continue the work, the good work that they've been doing. What is happening with this law that Jerry Brown signed?
Well, let me give you a little bit of background on this law, Jeanette. This is a law that was developed in concert with NARO, Pro-Choice America, and the State Attorney General, Kamala Harris. And basically, they were looking to develop a law that could pass muster on First Amendment grounds, because that has been an issue that has come up in other states that have tried to restrict the speech or otherwise regulate crisis pregnancy centers. And keep in mind, Jeanette, that there are really two groups of centers here, and the law addresses both groups. And that's something I learned in the process of writing the story. I didn't understand that well before. One is an unlicensed crisis pregnancy center that provides counseling and advertises itself, let's say, in Google search as a center to have pregnancy-related issues addressed. There's a second one, which are community-based, licensed crisis pregnancy centers that might go by a variety of different names, but usually have life in there somewhere. And they are licensed to provide a variety of medical and counseling services. Mm-hmm. And the law basically seeks to restrict and impose certain requirements on both groups.
And this law is restricting the groups, and what exactly is it requiring them to do? I mean, it seems quite contrary to their mission. They're being required to let their clients know about abortion. Isn't that correct?
Yes. As I mentioned, there are two rules governing the two different groups. The unlicensed crisis pregnancy centers are being asked to publicly disclose that they do not provide abortion services. So the key focus here is on public disclosure that they don't provide abortion. And of course, those who wrote this law feel like the most important thing is to direct people to where they can get abortions. That's their priority, not necessarily focusing on alternatives to abortion, which is what these crisis pregnancy centers do. Right. In the second case, with the licensed centers, they direct them to post information saying that they don't provide abortions, but also providing specific information about where they can get free or low-cost abortions. So some would see this really as imposing the requirement that these licensed pregnancy counseling centers actually do abortion referrals. Now, you can argue whether that is, in fact, what is being required. But I spoke with a clinic director, and not only do they get very specific information that they had to provide in this notice, in all their materials, in waiting rooms, and in a variety of settings, their marketing materials, they had to actually include a phone number, which they called and turned out to be Planned Parenthood.
Yeah, it's really an amazing turn there for these centers who, you know, are doing such good work to dissuade and to help people feel that abortion isn't their only option. And here they have to also go ahead and refer them to an abortionist. It's really amazing. How are these centers responding?
Well, what they have done is the Justice Institute has filed suit. It's called actually the Pacific Justice Institute, has filed suit on behalf of two centers. These are two licensed centers, and basically challenging the law, saying that it violates their free speech rights under the First Amendment. And the key thing here, Jeanette, is to find out, and this will be tested in the courts, whether the law, which was developed to address free speech concerns, as I mentioned earlier, in other states that tried to impose similarly burdensome laws on crisis pregnancy centers, this California law was developed reportedly to address those free speech concerns and hopefully survive any kind of legal challenge. And so the key issue will be, is that possible? Now, because the law addresses the two different groups, you have the public disclosure law for the unlicensed crisis pregnancy centers, which these California legislators insist misrepresent their services. Mm-hmm. And then you have the other group of licensed centers. So the public disclosure laws are the most likely to survive a legal challenge. But in the second group with the licensed centers, they're really forcing them to include information that really is not necessary. And as one lawyer representing the Pacific Justice Institute, the group representing these clinics said to me, he said it would be like forcing Alcoholics Anonymous to post information about where they can get free liquor.
Yeah.
So it's completely contradictory right. to the mission
right.
of these privately funded, privately organized, faith inspired institutions. And this is the kind of issue that, you know, normally free speech rights protects. So that will be the key issue when this comes, you know, comes before the courts. Right now, they're looking for a preliminary injunction to delay imposition of the law until they have a chance to fight this in court.
This is Jeanette DiMello on Register Radio. I'm speaking to Joan Frawley Desmond in California, and she's telling us about a couple of laws that were passed recently in California that are really anti-life laws, and one of those being a law that would require crisis pregnancy centers to refer to abortion centers, to also post information about the access to abortion in their clinics. Obviously, this is of great concern to pro-lifers in the state, and they are reacting, which we're grateful. Joan, you know, in your story that was published this week, let's see, on October 14th, California Crisis Pregnancy Centers file suit against a bully bill. You mentioned in the story, and you did at the beginning of this show, talk about the background of this bill, which was an investigation done by NARAL. They hired an investigator. It's somewhat reminiscent of the what is going on with Planned Parenthood now, the way that some pro-lifers were able to get information about what is happening in Planned Parenthood. It seems like there is some sort of battle going on here between NARAL, Planned Parenthood, and you know, some pro-life groups. It's almost like a tit for tat. Is this sort of a fight that is just ongoing between crisis pregnancy centers and groups like NARAL?
It's really striking. When you look at NARAL's Pro-Choice America's website, they clearly feel these crisis pregnancy centers pose a direct threat to them and to abortion rights. They don't, it's clear they don't want alternatives being presented. They see the alternatives as a violation of this constitutionally protected right to, you know, access to abortion. So that's where they're coming from what I can see. And the tit for tat, I would say, is a little more complicated. Basically what happened was is that they contracted with this young woman to go to 40 plus crisis pregnancy centers and find out the kind of information they were providing. They also did Google searches. Google searches are key to providing information about these centers. And so they questioned whether there was, you know, misrepresentation, mm-hmm. like if you type in the word abortion and you get the crisis pregnancy center, is that wrong, you know, that crisis pregnancy center using that kind of word? There's been a lot of debate around that. But in this case, they contracted with this woman to do this undercover investigation in the previous year. Then they brought this to light, you know, a little while ago, as a way of laying the groundwork for this law.
Yeah.
And so basically they tried to promote the idea that these clinics were misrepresenting information. Now, also keep in mind, because we have two different groups of clinics, and you have an array of different clinics with different strategies, different outreach efforts, different information, you could easily have some clinics following certain guidelines, other clinics following a different set of guidelines according to their own conscience and just their philosophy. And so you might easily identify some clinics that may present themselves in such a way.
Mm-hmm.
Honestly, I can't say because I haven't, you know, I haven't identified these clinics myself, but they could probably find somebody saying something that could be questionable in some way, shape, or form. Well, they then use this, let's keep in mind another thing, Jeanette. If you compare the whole discussion around the undercover videos that targeted Planned Parenthood that were released by the Center for Medical Progress, those videos were attacked as deceptive, and that people had gone there, you know, misrepresented themselves. Well, this young woman went there under contract to NARAL Pro-Choice America to investigate these crisis pregnancies. She doesn't provide any video testimony directly from the people.
Mm-hmm.
She comes out of the clinic and then does her own vocal summary of what happened. So there's no way to know whether what she said happened or didn't happen. You know, we don't know.
Yeah, and there's no huge controversy around this. Joan, we're almost out of time, and I did want to just ask you about another bill that was passed on October 5th, and it was in relation to assisted suicide. California now has legalized assisted suicide, and this is quite a surprise because during the summer we reported that we thought this bill was not going to pass this year. Very quickly, what happened?
Basically, in the middle of the summer, the bill to legalize assisted suicide got stuck in the Health Committee of the Assembly. There were a group of about five assemblymen, including several Latinos, Latino assemblymen and women, who said that they could not in conscience support the bill. They had various reasons for it. They said they wanted more time to evaluate it. Well, the bill was ultimately pulled. And then all of a sudden, when a special session was organized later in the summer by the governor, ostensibly to address a shortfall in funds for the state's low-income health plan, all of a sudden they delayed the debate of this shortfall of funds, and they introduced this and just ram it through the legislature. So just literally overnight blitzkrieg legislative strategy. And it circumvented the normal processes for debate, which people think was such an important bill. You need time to discuss it. A lot of the issues were not resolved, and instead it just was rammed through. So people are devastated about that. It's a huge blow for the Catholic bishops, who pushed very hard on this. So pro-life forces are really feeling the heat right now.
And I know we've got a story coming by Peter Smith, who's going to tell us about what's happening with this pro-life movement in the state of California. We'll expect that story soon, and hopefully it'll shed light on some of the movements that they'll be doing to try to reverse these actions this month. Joan, thanks for being with us today.
Oh, it's always a pleasure, Jeanette.
Don't forget, you can listen to the show again by going to ncregister.com. Look for the microphone to listen or download the show. Thanks for joining us on Register Radio. For our producer, Elena Rodriguez, Jeanette, and all of us at the Register and here at EWTN, I'm Tom Price. See you next week.
For more information about the National Catholic Register and about Register Radio, go to ncregister.com. Podcasts of Register Radio are posted on ncregister.com and on ewtn.com. Join us next week at this time for Register Radio on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.